This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Mirabai Bush. Download the MP3 of our produced show at onbeing.org. That wasn't you, was it? Yeah, that's what I thought. Hello? Hello, hello?
Hello.
Is that Mirabai?
It is Mirabai.
Hi, it's Krista.
Hi.
I'm so glad you made it safely.
I am too.
I did not want to have any damage to you on my conscience.
No, the roads were great. By the time I got on them.
Well,
the big roads.
I've been on texting and on email with various friends in that area who are all kind of freaked out about the weather.
Yeah, it's been a lot.
Yeah,
we're weary.
Yeah, yeah,
and
that's
it's a lot of shoveling and snow.
Yeah, somebody said grumpy. I'm grumpy.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Chris, do you want us to just chit-chat for a minute? All right.
Yeah, sure.
So tell me something. I'm so happy we're doing this, first of all, but I don't want to risk you saying anything profound until we're going. So tell me something mundane, like what you had for breakfast.
What I had for breakfast?
Yeah.
Granola, yogurt, and banana. Was very good.
Okay.
Although I wanted something warm, but I couldn't figure that out. So what I had for breakfast.
Get a gold star for healthiness.
Last week I was out at Canyon Ranch. So, you know, one has to be healthy for a while after that.
That's
I'm
well,
trying. I had a hip.
Lucky you, though.
Oh,
was that
fabulous.
Your award for having the hip?
Yeah, well, I went. There's one right near us in Lenox, Mass. And
yeah.
I went there to work with some folks to set up a program, you know, for re-strengthening. And I've actually had a fabulous recovery. I feel great. But I wanted to keep strengthening. So, and basically, of course, they told me everything I already know, but it was nice to hear it from somebody else.
Oh, I actually haven't been to Canyon Ranch. I mean, I've heard that it's really wonderful. So it's one of my aspirations.
Oh, my phone. Oh, okay. I'm doing it.
Okay. Chris, do you think we're good? Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
I do have water.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And do we have a hard stop or anything? Hard stop at 2:30 our time, 3:30 your time. Okay.
And is it okay if I drink water during
Yeah, absolutely. And this is totally, can be nonlinear and you can, you know, we can edit things out if you want to stop or if you want to go back to something, we'll edit it for broadcast.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just a real conversation.
Nothing I would rather do.
Okay. Well, can we begin? Okay. Terrific. So I wonder, how would you start to describe what the spiritual background of your childhood, of your life, your early life?
Well, my early life, I was brought up Catholic, and when I was seven, my father left and my mother had to go to work. And this was right after the war, I have to say, the Second World War. It used to be the war.
Right.
And there wasn't daycare. So my mother would drop me off at the church and I'd go to Mass every morning and then I'd just go right over to the school. They were both across the street from us. So I was in church every morning for my whole childhood. And, you know, there wasn't much to do there except try to pray, which I did. And I think that somehow all those hours opened something up for me that has been with me ever since. Mm-hmm. A kind of knowing that that we're here to pursue the big questions because it was a kind of Gothic church with high spires, and it had that effect that I think they're supposed to have of uplifting and, you know, taking your mind up into the upper reaches. And that's kind of what it was for me. And as I think you know, that Catholic children are part of the way morals and ethics are taught is through the models of the saint, the lives of the saints.
Right.
And so there were a lot of really pretty extraordinary and some preposterous stories of saints.
Yeah.
But I really loved Joan of Arc.
Yeah, I read that. I read that. And I think it's such an interesting idea that Joan of... And so I'm just wondering, how does Joan of Arc inspire the aspirations of a girl in Madison, New Jersey?
Well, for one thing, her life was a lot more interesting than mine. So I liked that. But she did start out as a kind of ordinary little girl. And then, I mean, the basics are that she started hearing God talking to her and telling her what to do. And as a little girl, you know, recognizing how confusing life is, I thought, wow, that would be so cool if you could hear what it was you were supposed to do.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that she did it. She did everything she heard, no matter how, you know, how out there it was. So she saved France. She cross-dressed and she saved France.
Right.
And but I loved that. And so somehow that stayed with me, that sense of wanting to be able to hear clearly what it was I should be doing with my life. And later, when I began to learn various contemplative spiritual practices, meditation, yoga, and so on, I realized that I was really – what I loved about it was that they help you get clear – calm, clear, open, better able to hear. It may, you know, it no longer seems to me like Joan experienced it as a great God in heaven speaking to her. But I feel like I've been able to hear better that what it is I'm supposed to be doing with my life and then, you know, doing it.
Oh, that's really great, lovely language. I mean, I do. You have a pretty amazing story of your own at this point, I have to say. I mean, you know, digging into all the things you did along the way, and I don't know. I mean, the Joan of Arc image is. It's also kind of socially engaged, I would say.
Yeah. Yes.
in a quite dramatic way. But so it's just, you know, let's just get you ended up kind of rediscovering contemplative tradition, I think, in India.
Yes.
You got there, though, it seems to me, as a child of the 60s and kind of driven to be moving and driven to search by your anguish at what was happening in the world, and you ended up kind of on this pilgrimage in 1969.
Yes.
And I think maybe later on you called it a pilgrimage, maybe at the time.
Yeah, yes.
Didn't feel quite as defined.
Yeah. At the time, I was in graduate school from 67 to 70, and those were the years that were so... There's so much upheaval on campus, and I got really involved in civil rights and then in anti-war work. You know, I would, you know, drive war resistors across the Canadian border. But there were all kinds of, you know, marching in Washington and being tear gassed. And then I was in the English department, and there were extraordinary people, and it was a time when people were beginning to experiment with psychedelics and some spiritual practice, but not so much. But the whole campus was just kind of turned upside down. And then the politics of it meant that the police came onto campus, and it was getting impossible. So I left just before. I had done all the work for my PhD except my dissertation, and I decided to take some time off. And I traveled overland with my partner then, and I traveled overland from London to Delhi. All through that is like going backward in time. It was then, before everything was so, you know, kind of globalized. And it was amazing because at that time, going through, you know, the former Yugoslavia and Iran and Afghanistan and Pakistan into India, every place was completely peaceful. And people everywhere took us into their homes. And we took a bus from London to Delhi. It was the longest bus ride in the world. It was two months. And and it cost like $400.
Right.
And but then we stopped in lots of places and got to know people all along the way, and also got to have some experience of their spiritual and religious practices all along the way. And that was really opening for me. You know, I had never really experienced much of anything besides Christianity and Judaism before that. Then I got to India, and I expected to stay for 2 weeks maybe in India. We were kind of, you know, searching for meaning.
Yeah.
And we were looking for it everywhere. And India was one of those places. But I got to India, and the first week I was there, I heard about a course that a Burmese Buddhist teacher was offering for Westerners for the first time. It was
for the very first time, right?
Very first time
for Westerners. Yeah,
and it was in Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha was enlightened.
Yeah.
And I did that course with many other people who are still my close friends. And
is it right that you? I read somewhere that you heard about that, or at least in part, because you ran into Sharon Salzberg on the streets in Delhi.
I did. Yeah. We had been at the same school.
Oh, you had? So you already knew her.
No, we didn't know each other there.
Oh.
And so, but we'd heard of each other.
Yeah.
And so she was an undergraduate in American Studies, and I was a teaching fellow. But we had heard, I guess, that each other might be in India. So yeah, so we met. There were very few Westerners then. I mean, there'd been the British Raj, and then there was a big gap, and then there was us. And so we met on the street, and she told me about this course. And it was her first time also. She had been doing some meditation kind of by herself in America. But so, yeah, we were roommates. We didn't really have a room, but for the first course, and we've been really good friends ever since.
You know, in something you wrote about that time, you say, you know, that you had this discovery, this experience. Say a little bit, though. I mean, I think you did say this a minute ago, but what you discovered. Let me ask you. You know, how would you talk about what you discovered in that experience of a serious introduction to contemplation, to meditation?
Well, first, you know, it's hard to talk about.
I know.
So,
yeah.
The most basic thing that I could look inside myself and learn about the nature of the mind and the nature of the world. And that, I was a literature student. I had read, you know, 1,000 books probably. And I was always looking outside for more ideas and, you know, more critical understanding and more content. We didn't call it content then.
But yeah.
We called it literature.
Right.
And and so just looking within was really stunning. And then that first course was from 5 in the morning till 10 at night. We just sat and meditated. We had guidance and teaching. Mm-hmm. But little by little, you know, I started getting really quiet and still. Of course, all kinds of things came up. But I really began to see that I was not my mind. I was not my body. I was those things, but I was also awareness. I could rest in awareness of my mind, of the sensations in my body. And as I began to see that, things just loosened up. And I began to see the basic nature of the impermanence of thoughts as they rise and fall away. And I just started taking them less seriously.
I
began to see, for example, I'd been trying to write my dissertation on poetry. And, you know, after weeks of doing this practice, I had this insight into, I was sitting there and my mind had gotten so focused. And I began to see that, you know, the power of words in poetry are that they have, that they're very focused and that they are full of potential. Mm-hmm. It just seemed obvious to me, as did many things, as I sat for long enough. Mm-hmm. It was really wonderful. I felt much less dependent on finding things outside. And it gave me a kind of radical self-confidence, like I belonged here on the planet and, you know, and that I would be able to understand the basics of how it's all unfolding. I would say that it also gave me kind of faith in the unfolding. Hmm. I like that you use the word sane faith. That's what it felt like. It felt like I had a faith in actually the way things are and that was okay.
I mean, I also, you know, I hear you saying, a minute ago you said you had a new insight into the mind, into your mind and into the world. And that's, you know, those two things belong together. But I feel like in your thinking and in the work you've done bringing contemplative practice back out to others, you've had a very focused way of attending to the intersection between those two things. And like, there's this wonderful line you wrote when you were writing about those early years. You said, a line I had heard Gary Snyder say while I was in graduate school came back to me: the mercy of the West has been social revolution. The mercy of the East has been individual insight into the basic self/void. We need both. And you continued, when I was first sitting in that Buddhist monastery in India, the merging of the two began to seem important for our future. And it seems to me that, you know, the world that has, let's use your word, unfolded in these 40, 50 years, you know, a big dynamic in it is these two strains of inner life and outer action kind of finding each other fitfully.
Yeah.
And, you know, you were really part of, you were also not, you know, unwittingly, I know none of you, when you and Sharon ran into each other in the streets of Delhi, and didn't really have a room, you know, to stay in. You didn't realize that you were going to be part of this movement that brought, you know, you and a lot of other mostly Jewish and some Christian kids, then kind of really importing Buddhism back into the West. It must be pretty amazing to think back on it now. That way.
It is. I mean, when we first came back, I mean, the idea, I mean, we were so marginalized, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
And We didn't quite know what to do with it, but many of us were really profoundly affected by it and felt that in some way or other we wanted to, well, first integrate it into our own lives fully and then share it with others. And so, but a number of the people who were I was with then and came back were, well, most of them were single and came back and wanted to teach and so began meditation centers, Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg. And Jack Kornfield wasn't with us in India. He was in Thailand when we were in India, but we all met when we got back. And a number of other Buddhist teachers were there also, who became Buddhist teachers.
Right, right.
But I... when I came back, so I was going to stay for 2 weeks, and I stayed for 2 years in India. And I was with – I did much more practice with Goenka, who was our teacher there, and with Tibetan teachers. And then I also had a Hindu teacher who was Ram Dass's teacher, Neem Karoli Baba, and I stayed with him for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so when I came back 2 years later, I was pregnant and married and had a child then. And so I couldn't – when we first came back, meditation, we still had the model of it being monastic. And so we, having a child and being a meditation teacher was just – no one could imagine that. So,
right.
So I had – but I was just as committed as everybody else to finding a way to bring this into our lives in the West. So I decided to find ways to bring it into – first, I started a business with my then-husband, John Bush. And
right. Was this the Illuminations?
Yeah. We started out doing silkscreen icons, mandalas of we tried to think of what was the central image, central iconic image of every spiritual and religious tradition, and we came up with the mandala. And so we did, we silk screened these images, everything from the rose window at Chartres to Tibetan and Hindu mandalas, and lots of things, lots of something for every tradition. And we still screen them on plastic, and people put them on the back of their car windows and are on their house windows, and they became
these rainbow decals,
thing.
Right?
Then we did rainbows, yeah.
And okay, and the rainbows are – oh, I see. And the rainbows are one, the ones I think became iconic, right?
Yeah, they did.
Every
VW
bug had
leap.
One in the
– yeah, they made the leap out of the new age. And we didn't think we should sell them. We were just testing the colors of our inks. Yeah. We said, how should we test colors? Well, what could we silkscreen that would have all the colors in it? And then it was like, oh, yeah, the rainbow. And then we thought, this isn't very spiritual. We can't sell this. And then, of course, we realized that it was the universal symbol of peace and harmony right out of the Bible. So we did, and yeah, and it just – we were
– and you became a successful businesswoman. You were an entrepreneur. There's even that article about you with Steve Jobs on the other side.
Yeah, isn't
that
funny?
At that point was – still a very noble and notable entrepreneur, but he'd just been ousted from Apple and he was starting a new company.
Yeah. I thought, I don't know who wrote that or edited that article, but I thought when they look back, they must have thought, I didn't get this quite right. You know, it's like, here are a few New Age entrepreneurs. Here by Steve Jobs.
Right.
That was great. But what I was most interested in at Illuminations was integrating this sense, not just practice, because not everybody who worked there wanted to learn to meditate, but we integrated it in ways into the business that I thought would So the business would embody the perspective and the spirit and the values of contemplative practices. Mm-hmm.
Seems to me that you always had this, you've pulled this through in your career, this connection between contemplation and the arts and design.
Yeah.
And I guess actually what you just pointed out is also how that connection is really there in all the traditions, as well as a contemplative tradition. But that's interesting. It's not something people talk about a lot.
Yeah. It was a way to express that. You know, that was the beginning of the time when we were discovering, you know, it's all one.
Yeah.
I mean, now we recognize that it's more complicated and subtle and so on, and it is all one, and yet it's more than that. But at the time, that was radical.
Yeah.
So we really wanted to express it, and we knew that doing it visually would be easier for people than trying to do it in words, as you can appreciate.
Yeah.
So we at Illuminations, we were trying to create an organization based on principles of what they call in the East right livelihood,
yeah.
where what you're making is wholesome and contributes to, now we would say, you know, sustainability of the planet and the
right.
species, and at the same time the way in which you're doing it is helping everyone who's involved to wake up. And so we did so many things that many years later arrived at Google, because they wanted to have a program there where their engineers could learn meditation. So many of the same things that they've recognized about what makes a person more creative, more able to bring their whole self into work, and to be able to grow from their work as well, and not think of it as, you know, now I'll do my work and then I'll go home and be a real person.
Right. But that has. That is a shift that is still has a long way to go.
Oh, for sure.
In terms of American corporate culture and ideals and practicalities.
Yeah.
But it is something you've been. I mean, there is a shift. The shift has been happening, and you've been part of that.
Yeah.
The story of Search Inside Yourself. First of all, I love the story of how you, when you, that you had to find that language. I mean, isn't it right
yeah.
that when you first started, when maybe you were invited to think about something, but when you first just were offering a meditation course or a mindfulness course, it didn't take?
Yeah. Actually, I was, excuse me, my friend Meng, who's now written the book on Search Inside Yourself, he wanted to bring meditation.
Is he that Jolly Good Fellow? Is that his title?
Yes, he yeah. is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
he called me up one yeah. day. I was at the still running the Center for Contemplative Mind. And he called up and he said, someone told me that you might be able to help me. I wanted to bring meditation into Google. He said, well, first of all, he said, when I was younger, he'd been through some difficult times, and meditation had really helped him. So he'd been thinking for some time at Google that it would be really great to bring into the workplace. He'd been there since almost the beginning. He was engineer number 107. and then he said to me on the phone, I thought this was funny because I didn't know anyone actually talked this way, but he said, so I told myself that when I got rich, I would spend my time bringing meditation into the place.
Right.
I haven't heard anyone say that since I was like seven.
Right,
you know, when
right.
I grow up and I get rich.
Right.
So anyhow, I said, well, did you? And he said, yeah, I did. That was, since then, I've spent a lot of time in Silicon Valley, and I realized a lot of people say that out there.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, when Google went public, they told their engineers that who no longer needed to work if they didn't want to, that they could stay, but they had to do something that would in some way advance Google's mission. But they could decide what it was. So Meng decided it was going to be bringing meditation. And he called me and he said, so I was going to do this, and I found somebody who was teaching mindfulness-based stress reduction. That's the program that started with John Kabat-Zinn at the University of Massachusetts. And I posted it. And at Google, there's lots of offerings posted, and you can do all kinds of things. And he said, I posted it, and nobody signed up. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to do. And I heard you could help. So I went out there, and we talked, and we looked around. And what we identified was that employees there are – all quite young, very smart, graduated at the top of their class from MIT or Stanford, had been in front of their screens most of their lives because they are so young. They've from early on, they're really good at writing algorithms, but they weren't so good at self-awareness and awareness of others. Emotional intelligence, essentially, because they've been just really working, studying, being, you know, top of their class.
Yeah.
And then they got to Google and they went right to work and they're really good. But they also have to work in teams and they have to work together in many different ways. It's also there are also a lot of cultural differences there. I would say I don't know the real numbers, but it feels like it's about a third Indian, a third Chinese, and a third a mix of everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of misunderstandings in communication because of all those cultural differences. So after talking for a whole day and figuring out what was going on there, I suggested that we could offer the same practices, but emphasize the practices that are that more directly cultivate emotional intelligence, and that we could frame it in a different way. And so we called it. Of course, they came up with this great name since they're the big search engine, Search Inside Yourself. And then the subtitle was Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. And we asked Danny Goleman, who also was in Bodh Gaya with us back all those years ago, asked him to give a talk at Google about the relation between – about why emotional intelligence is so important in the workplace and the relationship between meditation and emotional intelligence. He did that, and then we posted the course, and in 4 hours, 140 people signed up.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, you know, over 2,000 – Googlers around the world have taken the course, and there's a lot of talk now about bringing mindfulness into the workplace and how superficial it is and how it helps bad people do bad things better and it doesn't help people question anything. It just makes them more satisfied with what they're doing. But this is a serious course.
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen that it goes beyond people. Of course, the first, when you sit down and quiet down, become calm, quiet, stable, you have to do that in order for any kind of insight to arise. And it does, you do feel better usually, although sometimes, you know, really disturbing emotions arise. Mm. But so it needs to be taken to the next kind of level of depth in order for people to begin to question, inquire.
Right.
And but this course actually offers enough time, practice, and teaching to help people do that.
I mean, yeah, and I think that's an important and refreshing thing to name, that yes, you can be a great meditator and also remain narcissistic, right?
Yes.
I mean, this can be superficial and it can be abused like any spiritual practice, like
yeah.
any political
yeah.
practice. But you know, Mirabai, something that really so intrigues me in your work is in some of your writing is how you know, the language of emotional intelligence that you've just been using and that's now so widely familiar, including in workplaces, that what this tradition is bringing forward and bringing to the surface for modern people has these, you know, has this very noble lineage. You know, it's Buddhism that is the tradition that has focused on this for thousands of years. But, you know, when you also did the work before your corporate work, and I want to talk some more about that in a minute, but I also just want to pull back to this big picture. I mean, when you did the contemplative mind in society, when you helped helped bring mindfulness practices and virtues into higher education across disciplines, mm-hmm. you know, you wrote about how in 1890, William James in The Principles of Psychology said that the faculty of voluntarily bringing back a wandering attention over and over again is the very root of judgment, character, and will. And
yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I don't think he was Buddhist, but that is the intention, right? Of
yeah, that is the intention.
And that's just quite amazing. And then in the 70s, you had somebody who actually I had never heard of, David McClelland.
Yeah.
In William James Hall.
Mm-hmm.
who became a teacher to all these figures who've gone on, especially in neuroscience, to open
yeah,
up this field.
Yeah.
Richie Davidson, Daniel Goleman, Cliff Sarin, Mark Epstein. And also to me, what's fascinating is that he was Quaker. And there's
mm-hmm.
there's something in your work, there's this thread you've pulled through in seeing that this contemplative impulse is a kind of human, it's a human tradition as much as it's
yeah.
it's in the religious traditions. In Mies van der Rohe and C.S. Lewis and the idea of beholding that goes back to Plato and Heidegger, somehow that you're just looking at your work has brought all that forward for me. And it's really,
Chrissy,
really fascinating.
You read so much. I'm honored.
but
it's true. But actually, at the center, when we started the Center for Contemplative Mind, we were looking for ways in which these practices might be helpful in sectors of American society other than health and healing, which is where it had started.
Right.
We interviewed 80 people we identified. This is in 96 and 7, so it was early. But we kind of word of mouth heard and knew a number of people in different fields who were beginning to integrate it into their work or their organizations. And we interviewed 80 people and we asked them for what practices they were theirs and that they were teaching. We gathered these maybe, I don't know, 100 practices from all the different traditions. All the religious and spiritual and, of course, psychological traditions too. They are human practices. They're really about waking up to who we are, appreciating who we are, opening our hearts, recognizing compassion, recognizing that, you know, there's a way in which there's much that we all share, even with all of our differences, and that waking up to that is a can happen through these practices. So we created what we call the tree of contemplative practices. It's on the website.
Yeah, no, I actually have that in front of me. Yeah, that.
Yeah, and just put all the sorted out the practices and put them on there. And I would say more than anything else we've done over all these years, that has made such an impact. It's kind of like going back to the mandalas we did at Illuminations. Mm-hmm. People love to know that this basic human, that there is at the core of our being something that we all share, and that we are all, you know, the Buddha say every being wants to be happy. You know, everybody wants to wake up and become more fully who they are. And these practices have been developed over thousands of years.
Yeah.
And really, mindfulness exists in almost every tradition, but it's not called mindfulness. But, you know, there is a calming, quieting, centering practice that leads into insight in every tradition.
Yeah. I mean, we'll put this tree of contemplative practices online. But, you know, I just want to read, you know, some of them. First of all, there are the different branches. There's stillness. There's generative. There's creative, activist, relational, movement, ritual, cyclical. And it's everything from centering to meditation to visualization, lectio divina, music, contemplative arts, journaling, social justice, work and volunteering, vigils, bearing witness, deep listening, storytelling, labyrinth, yoga, tai chi, retreats, ceremonies, and rituals. It opens up the whole. It opens up this. You know, it takes the idea of contemplative. Practice and awakening out of a box, out of any kind of narrow box.
Yeah. When we would share the tree or start talking about the practices with all kinds of different people, almost always someone would say, oh, I have a contemplative practice in my life, you know?
Yeah.
I walk silently in the woods on Saturday mornings, you know, or whatever it was. The tree helped people discover that and feel that it wasn't an esoteric or foreign thing, and so then would be more open to exploring some of the other practices.
Yeah. You know, and I actually do want to say that I'm a big one for not needing to rush to say, oh, we're all the same after all, you know? I mean, what you discovered in India and have built on, you know, has incredible depth to it and a lineage and teachers and development over years. So, but I don't think that honoring that exists in a tension with the fact that there's also something that there are reflections and mirrors and echoes of this across the traditions. It seems to me that's what you've been kind of calling out to and opening up for people. So let's talk about where, like, the rubber meets the road then. Let's get back down to the granular,
where is that?
Gritty level. Well, like, so I want to talk about the stuff you do in workplaces. Mm-hmm. And this is Google, but it's other places as well. And, you know, it is true of us 21st century people that where we work is in very large part where we spend our lives, for many of us. So, you know, one of the things you've talked about is, well, just talk about I don't know what you would call them, the exercises or the practices that you can take people through that bring this knowledge down to earth in terms of working life.
Yeah. Well, I think one really powerful exercise at work or anywhere is what we call mindful listening. Some people call it deep listening. And I actually first learned it from two lawyers who were mediators. So, and it's sometimes used in therapy also. But but we don't use it nearly enough. and which is just we do it as a practice together when it's taught, but you can it can be modified so that you can listen this way even when you're at a meeting or just with another person. And in the practice, two people sit opposite each other, and we ask the person who's listening to listen as if they first learn some mindfulness meditation practice, which is simply closing your eyes, noticing your breath moving in and out. And as thoughts and emotions arise, you just let them go and bring your mind back to your breath. That's the essence of it. So in mindful listening, we ask people to bring their mind fully to the person opposite them who is speaking. We'll give the speaker a simple prompt, and they'll just start talking about something. And we ask the listener to listen fully, and as thoughts and emotions and distractions arise in their minds, or even helpful like, oh, I went through that too and I would like to tell you about it. All of that, as it arises in the mind, we ask them to just let it go and come back to the person in front of them. And of course, that happens if they're speaking for 5 minutes. If a person's speaking for 5 minutes, that happens in the listener's mind 50 times.
Right, right.
And then they just keep coming back and listening. And then they feedback, then they stop and feedback what I heard you saying was. And then the speaker says, well, that's almost right, but you kind of got it a little off. So then they talk until the speaker feels heard, and then they switch roles. But almost every time people say both, I have never really listened like that. I'm just always listening as much to my own mind as to the person who's speaking. And not that it's good things might not arise in your mind, mm-hmm. but in as much as they keep you from listening to the other person, they're a distraction. And people also say, I never felt so listened to and so heard, and it really made me want to speak the truth as best I could. So that practice is great for the workplace. And if you don't have an opportunity to do it with another person, if you're not like part of a little workshop or something, then you can do it yourself, of course, as you're listening to another person.
Oh, right. You can just,
of course,
make it your own
discipline. You, of course, are the penultimate listener,
right.
So
right.
You know this. But most of us don't respect listening as a practice. It's just kind of happening to us. So that's a good one for the workplace.
So, you know, you did years ago, you did really extensive work with top executives at Monsanto, which was, a few generations ago in Monsanto's life. But, you did like multiple-day silent retreats, right, with the entire executive. And so I just want to ask you about something you said, wrote about the most notable change in the largest group, which included scientists and some of the foundation team, was a shift from cynicism to hope. And that's maybe the kind of exercise you're describing, but it was a real immersion in a kind of contemplative practice and becoming mindful. So, that is such an intriguing statement. So what is it about this practice that instills hope?
As you said, that those were retreats. They were 3-day silent retreats where they were, meditating, both doing mindfulness practice and also a loving kindness practice for all beings and compassion practices of where you recognize that the other persons are just like me. They have a body and mind just like me. They make mistakes and feel pain and want to be happy just like me. It's more expanded. So there are a number of practices. But I think what happens, or and what I noticed in those early retreats is that people experience more spaciousness in their minds when they gave themselves the opportunity, they're breathing in and breathing out and letting go of all their lists of things to do, that there was an opening that made them feel like things don't have to go exactly the way, you know, at this moment we've planned that they go. It's much bigger than that. And we are in touch with our creativity, that things can change. It's another thing, as you watch your mind constantly changing, you know, rising and falling away, you begin to understand that the nature of life is change. Everything is changing all the time. And so those things about their work that feel really stuck, that this also can change. So there's always hope that for something better or different if you know that everything's changing, even when it feels like it's really
you start to
not.
Trust and be able to imagine and trust in possibility, even if it's something you can't define, it's that possibility is there and you believe in it.
Yes. Now, it's hard to say all this and use it with the example of Monsanto just before they got into
right.
You know, but the truth is that they, I don't know, it's hard to even talk about, but they really did believe at that very beginning point that they had studied the population statistics and they saw that, you know, that there if everything went the way it was going, that there wasn't going to be enough food for the planet for the 21st century. And they saw a way in which they could increase yields and it would still be good business. And mm-hmm. it looked really good to them. And they went ahead with it. But many other things happened in between. So, you know, it keeps changing. And so we have to keep practicing mm-hmm. because you have to, in every moment, you have to, you know, be awake to what the, you know, to what the right choices are in that moment.
And you've also worked, I think, with social activists. I mean, these are just people who work in other spheres, right? I mean, environmental activists or leaders of environmental organizations. And again, there it seems that what you find is that, and this was an interesting one, that, you know, an environmental leader who found that he became less overwhelmed by climate change predictions.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, that is a big theme for professors of environmental science mm-hmm. In schools across the country. There's one professor said his students call him Dr. Doom because he only has bad news. That was kind of a joke, but it was also true that his students weren't able to hold it. It was too much. And they felt like they weren't going to be able to do anything about it. And so they held it at a real distance and couldn't really open themselves up to trying to figure out in what way things could change. And he and many others have found that by doing a range of contemplative practices in the classroom with these students, that they're much better able to take it in and not be so terrified
right,
that they close down to it.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, Mirabai, we're all, as far as the climate goes or the weather or, you know, whatever we want to call it, whatever language you want to use, I think we are kind of collectively waking up to the fact that, you know, the things we've taken for granted about the natural world, let's just say it that way. You know, I think maybe everyone would agree on that. But it's so true for all of us that, you know, this language you use about mindfulness is allows you to be present to suffering and not overwhelmed by it, to bear witness to suffering and not take it on. I mean, I think that is a challenge for everybody who watches the news at night.
Especially with, well, I just remembered this year I taught, this year the freshmen at Amherst College had, they all had to choose a 3-day orientation and in their first week at school. And out of 400 entering students, 70 chose meditation and yoga. Huh. So there's a big change.
Yeah.
So I taught it with a friend who taught the yoga. And the first day, you know, I was teaching them mindfulness and having them, you know, watch their breath, which they had just arrived on campus. They were, and they had, like, worked like fiends, you know, to be able to get into Amherst.
To arrive on campus, yeah.
Right. Yeah, they, 400 were chosen out of 8,000. So, you know, you can imagine what their high school careers were like. So they got there, and they thought that mindfulness would be helpful, but, you know, it was really hard for them to slow down. So the beginning, and also, you know, they're all just kind of feeling out their who they are and, you know, what their look is. And so I had just taught college faculty, basically the same thing. And, of course, college faculty like to talk all the time. That's what they do. So I left a lot of space for, I'd say, oh, I teach the practice, and then I'd say, so any reflections on that? Any questions? And there'd be dead silence. So, okay, we'll practice a little more. And then I'd ask again, and nobody would make themselves vulnerable enough to ask a question.
Right, right.
So I decided, oh, better change this around. So I decided to give them a practice of the next morning, or the practice of mindfulness of an object. And I gave them each a leaf. And they were to bring their awareness to the leaf, and then as distractions arose, let them go and bring your mind back to your leaf. So we did that for 5 or 10 minutes, which is a long time to look. Mm-hmm. You know, usually you look at a leaf and you say, oh, okay, I saw it, and then you put
right.
it down. But the way in which, you know, generations ago or hundreds of years ago, people were more easily with nature, with indigenous people, you know, they'd really be there with it.
Yeah.
And so their minds, I asked them to bring their minds back over and over. So then, I didn't really expect that anybody was going to say anything. But so I left a couple of moments at the end and nobody did. And then this one football player in the back row raise his hand. And he had become in my mind the person who most was kind of resisting
right.
doing anything, making himself vulnerable in any way. He said, can I say something? I said, definitely. He said, I love my leaf.
Oh.
Oh. It was so beautiful.
Yeah.
And then they all started talking about how, you know, what it was like to really look and look and look. And it just made me realize that, you know, it's so much easier to do the things that we've done. What I know that some Christian groups call crimes against creation.
Hmm.
You know, when we're so out of touch with nature. And anyhow, it's just a moment of that one moment, like, is kind of this window into what we need to remember in order to make the right decisions for the future.
It also, you know, sometimes I feel like we've hit the 21st century, and I think of this as kind of spiritual technology, right? Meditation, mindfulness, and contemplation. And
yeah.
It's almost like we like we're discovering all these other technologies, and then we're kind of waking up to this spiritual technology that we kind of just need to bring us back to our senses almost. I mean, I wonder a lot about, I've just become aware recently of how, you know, whenever you stand in line these days, or do anything that involves waiting, we're all on our phones immediately. We're never alone, and we're never, you know, we're always engaged with our phones. And I'm kind of starting to wonder, like, what did we used to do?
Yeah.
Right? Did we? I mean, I don't know. You're talking about looking at a leaf, but I mean, did we look around? And I mean, I know there was boredom. There's no romance attached to this, but somehow we survived and flourished. And it just makes me wonder what was happening in our minds or inwardly then, or even in terms of our relationship to the world we were standing in.
Yeah.
That is completely gone now.
Daydreaming. Which research has found that daydreaming is good for your brain. I don't think we do as much of that. When teaching these students also, we at the end of the day, we did the yoga and a deep relaxation. And, of course, they weren't allowed to use their phones during the day.
Mm-hmm.
But so did Shavasana, deep relaxation. And everyone who's ever done a yoga class, you know, knows that's like, okay, this is the time, you know, you completely let go and you drop into the floor, you know. And as soon as like breathing in and breathing out, about three breaths in, and I saw these arms reach out. They went for their phones and brought, lying down on the floor.
Right.
They brought their phones in front of their faces. I couldn't believe it. It was like the little Catholic girl in me thought it was so sacrilegious.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, but okay. So, and you've done all that beautiful work with Google, and Google is part of the problem here.
Right? Yeah.
To the point that nothing is pure. And but you've also written about very practical, like mindfulness practices, like social media practice, mindful emailing. Would you talk about that?
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. We devised that at Google, and Oprah loved that. She put it in her magazine.
Okay.
It's so simple, but like most mindfulness practices, it's so simple and we don't do it. Type out your email, either a response or an initiating email, and then you stop, take three deep breaths, follow your breath in and out, and in and out, and in and out, and then you read the email. And you read it from the perspective of the person who is going to receive it. And there we were focused on emotional impact. So, you know, is the person going to – is this likely to make – is this person likely to be, you know, agitated or angry or, you know, frustrated or whatever the emotion would be, negative emotion – or maybe even is this person likely to think you mean you're offering more than you actually are? Whatever.
Right.
We ask them to think about it from that person's perspective and then either, you know, change it or not and then send. And the first time we did it, there was a week in between the classes. And so a week later they came back and we said, how did it go? And they all said, that was radical. You know, it was like amazing. Mm. And then one guy said, I did something really radical. I said, what? He said, I picked up the phone.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, there we all are emailing to the people in the next cubicle, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's really helpful. Really helpful.
Mm.
I wanted to go back for a minute because I didn't answer your question about social justice activism, really.
Yeah, yeah.
I got off on the leaf. But
yeah.
I just want one theme that comes up so often with activists is that if I give up my anger, will I lose my motivation? Right. And it's my anger that keeps me working for this change.
Yeah.
And what mindfulness, compassion practices, and others help with is the understanding that it's not either acting out on your anger and being driven by it on the one hand or repressing it on the other hand, but there is a way to notice your anger, begin by noticing the sensations in your body, and then notice what your anger is, see it, and recognize it as energy in your body.
Right.
But at the same time, hold compassion and equanimity for the situation and be able to, because you're more likely to be able to see what can be done to make that change if you're not driven by anger, because it clouds the mind. And it also makes communication with people on the other side of an issue really difficult.
Yeah.
Whereas if you can cultivate equanimity and compassion for the situation, you're much more likely to both see interesting ways to resolve it, and to be able to act on it and communicate it. Lawyers brought up, we did a lot of work with lawyers and judges and law students.
Yeah, I was reading about that. I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah.
That was so interesting. A special retreat for judges where they wanted to learn how to be non-judgmental.
Yeah. we laugh, but it's, lawyers worry that can they be a zealous advocate for their client and at the same time have compassion for the person on the other side of the case? Mm. And, of course, the answer is yes, but one has to cultivate deep compassion and equanimity in order to do that. And, again, in fact, you're more likely to win because you're more likely to see the whole thing without judgment. And what that means and what those judges meant is not eliminating wise discernment. It's eliminating prejudgment. So that judges are unbelievably overworked. May it change if they change some of these, victimless drug laws. Mm-hmm. But they have so many people coming in front of them all day long, one after another. And they said, some young guy comes up in front of me, and before I, even know his name, I'm already thinking, that this is probably who he is and what he's done.
Right.
And they can't not have that arise because there they are all day long hearing all this stuff. But they don't want it. They don't want to prejudge. They want to be really there in the moment, clear and open-minded with whomever comes before them. But it's really hard. So mindfulness of being in the moment, letting go of prejudgments, just being there and really listening to what's actually being said. That can be cultivated through mindfulness practice, and they loved it.
Mm.
Yeah,
I just read in a science magazine that the present moment as we experience it is about 2 to 3 seconds long. Kind of interesting, right?
Yeah.
That physically, what we experience as the present moment is two.
I know. I mean, some philosophers say there is no present moment. There's
right.
only the past and the future. That this moment,
But
it's gone.
I think, physiologically, we now see that it's true that there is the present moment, and also that it can feel longer, right? Which is also something meditators have said.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that you can also completely not be there; you can just miss it.
All of the above.
Yeah. You said a minute ago, with everything, mindfulness and contemplative practice, it's so obvious and in some ways easy, but we don't do it. And you know, I have to, and I have to say, like, for myself, I have, I've had many experiences across the years in different settings, retreat settings, or, you know, something less intense, where it, I mean, the irony is that a even a kind of one-off contemplative experience can be instantaneously gratifying, right? I mean, it can be, yeah. It can be just transformative. And yet, and now there's even all this science about how good it is for us on these very basic yeah. biological levels and stress and all of that. But it's very hard to create this habit. And it has been hard for me. I have recently, I wanted to ask you about this since I have you. You know, I recently decided that I could do 6 minutes in the morning while my tea steeps, which just seems so petty, you know, pathetic. But it's,
yeah,
it's
as
been,
you said,
it's
outside time.
Yeah. And I wonder, it seems to me that this matter of what practices you use or, you know, what habits you take on, how long and where and what style, we have all these different personalities and all these different lives. And yeah. I mean, I want to ask you, because you work with so many different practices. I mean, is this something where you really do have to find the way that works for you?
Yeah. Well, at the center, we've done all kinds of things. I mean, we've had retreats where we've offered, you know, we've had a Buddhist teacher and a Jewish teacher teaching traditional Jewish practices, Brother David teaching Christian practices, yeah. Someone doing Sufi chanting. We've done it that way. And then invite people to find something from all of that that works for them. Sometimes we've offered really simple practices like mindfulness of the breath and walking meditation,
right.
and mindful listening and so on as an opening for people. And then knowing that if they begin to appreciate, the inner life and the benefit that comes from, as you said, I mean, it's amazing that they found the reduction in stress and cortisol levels
yeah.
after 10, 15 minutes of meditation, that once people begin to experience that they will find what works for them. In the work that I did all this year with Fetzer Institute, they wanted to find practices that would work for their entire staff of 65 people.
Right.
And they have a wide range of skill sets. I mean, they're groundskeepers and kitchen people and, you know, program managers and financial people right. and so on. And they came from lots of different backgrounds. And not just spiritual and religious backgrounds, but there are people there whose parents came from China and Afghanistan and Eritrea. And so we had to find practices that worked, that we had to find a program that would work for everyone. And basically what we did was we'd start each morning when we would do these practices with mindfulness, and we'd invite people for whom mindfulness was even too much to just sit in silence or to sit in silence and do whatever they did, which might be a prayer or
right.
some other form of meditation. So we do 15 minutes or so in silence with a light mindfulness being led. And then after that, we, on different days, we'd offer different practices. People could choose those practices, or they could choose to experiment with those practices, including the arts and practices in nature and all a whole range of things like the tree. And or they could choose to just go to – we had a quiet room where there were some art supplies and some spiritual books, or you could just sit there in silence or do whatever practice you wanted to do yourself. But you just had to commit that time to be a reflective time, not to be at your desk going through your to-do list. Right. And it's been amazing. I mean, we've had to work in all kinds of ways to refine it and shift it and change it. But it's been really remarkable, the effect it's had on the whole community. So
keep going. What were you going to say?
Yeah.
Would you talk a little bit about
the other thing I wanted to say is that there's so much work being done with mindfulness, and that is a great introductory practice. But what I have found, in the beginning, you couldn't ever say what the environmental leaders would call the L word. And they didn't mean lesbian. They meant the L word was love. And there are practices. The most used is the loving kindness practice that Sharon Salzberg has really written a lot about.
Right.
But the compassion practices are related to that, in which are more about appreciation for others and a desire to relieve the suffering of others. But that whole group of practices, the truth is, when I think back over all the moments, people of introducing these practices to all these different kinds of folks, that it's really when someone's heart opens that things really change. Mm. And you can't ever predict how that's going to happen. It doesn't always happen through doing loving kindness practice. But I have been more and more willing to take the risk to offer those practices, even in just very secular working situations recently than I used
like
to be.
Loving kindness meditation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because people really want to be loved, it turns out.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to talk about it, and it, you know, it's it always edges on sounding like a Hallmark card, but I have found it to be very powerful if you can find the right way to do it.
You've also been working with people in the Army.
Yeah, they want to be loved too.
Yeah.
That taught me. I mean, for me, going through all this, the big thing has been just when I thought, you know, oh, I'm beyond thinking that they're, you know, in terms of self and other, you know, that's all us.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm confronted with another invitation, like to the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered that within me, it turned out I didn't think it was all us. I thought that they were really different. But, and it's...
And this is you who drove draft Dodgers across the Canadian border
right.
50 years ago.
So anti-war.
Right. Yeah.
But as they said to me, some of them at one point, Mirabai, the Army doesn't take us to war. Civilians take us to war. We just follow orders. Hmm. I thought, oh, my God. In that moment, I realized, of course. And it wasn't that I didn't know that. But, you know, I realized that all that whole domain was vague in my mind. And anyhow, it's a long story to talk about the Army, but what I did discover is that that they really they have been taught. The Army's been really military. It's been really good at teaching people to go into a situation, to see what's going on in that situation, and then to use basically as much force as possible to eliminate any threat.
Right.
And that now is counterproductive in almost every setting that they find themselves in. So I worked with them when they were, you know, mainly in Iraq and Afghanistan, and going into those villages, that was the last thing that they should be doing because, of course, I mean, apart from the moral and ethical issue, that it was counterproductive for them because then the whole village would turn against them. So they had to learn to go into a situation and be aware of what was going on and then use force only as a last choice. And that, you know, it took deconditioning and it took some real real mindfulness. And in the process, it was really helping to, you know, to support life, save life, their own and the people in the communities. And so I felt like it was a good thing to do.
So we're almost out of time, really, where so I just want to ask you one. Oh, we have a couple more minutes. Good, so I don't have to rush this too much. I mean, it sounds to me like, as you've written about that, that I mean, dealing with people who have been at war and are sending other people into war is kind of the extreme case of being present to suffering and not overwhelmed by it, or bearing witness to suffering and not taking it on. But again, you know, I'll say again, as I was getting ready to interview you, I think about, you know, a lot of the anguishing things that are on many of our minds, the wars that are going on in the world. Also, the issues like income inequality, which I think so many of us are troubled by without having any idea what to do about it. Or race. Again, what, you know, this huge question that feels kind of hopeless about how to possibly make a difference. And I want to read back something you wrote about, you know, from your earliest days. You know, as unlikely as contemplative practice as a strategy for social change seemed to me when I arrived in India, it slowly began to look like a critical component in the creation of a more just and compassionate global society. So I wonder if you just reflect here as we finish for a few minutes on, you know, in both lofty and practical ways about how, you know, what you've learned, like how can this kind of practice speak to those, that kind of anguish? I mean, contemplative practice as a strategy for social change. What does that look like?
Well, we've all thought about race again a lot recently. And I mean, so much of what practice is about is making what's going on in the mind available and obvious to us, as with our awareness we are watching our minds. And a lot of what's behind all the issues that have to do with race now is this unconscious implicit bias.
Right. Which is a version of what those judges talked about, right? That somebody comes and they have these ideas about whether they're guilty or innocent. It's not actually based on that person.
Partly it's and in part because of the income and inequality, lots of people's lives are separate from each other. And so they actually don't have any friends in other races, and they don't know what their lives are like. And so they're stunned when they hear that, you know, that black men are, you know, held up more often on the street by police than white ones. But for those kind of in between who actually and many of those people are in a position to certainly make cultural and political change. A lot of it has to do with biases that they're that are unconscious to them. That's certainly a big piece of it. Mm-hmm. It's going on in the universities, going on, and so I do think that contemplative practice can help there. I also think that, people have actually used and introduced practices to police forces and where they to begin to appreciate others in the sense recognizing the way in which recognizing their own bias, and so as it arises when they see a young black guy and reaching for their gun immediately, will be more aware and be less likely to do that. Looking at their own fear, because that seems to be a big factor. Looking at fear instead of repressing it or just channeling it into aggression. All of these things can be helped by mindfulness practices. And then, as I said, I just think the practices that have to do with compassion and appreciation for each other, you know, if the more widely they can be practiced, the more likely we are to be more fair and just in our behaviors toward others. Fear, dealing with fear is a lot. Because I think the more exposure we have to each other, the less likely we are to objectify each other and then not care about
If you think about, I think that we tend to hold up the '60s, and in fact, a lot of people who you knew, or in these circles you moved in, as kind of how we think social change happens, and it was about masses of people on the street, or about very high profile kind of personal transformation, but none of that brought us far enough. The thing about, you know, the idea that contemplative, that somehow developing powers of self-reflection can be powerful in any given life, I think seems obvious. But the link between that and, you know, real social change, gosh, it sounds like if nothing else, it might take forever.
But, you know, these things are, it doesn't happen in a linear way. And, you know, there, as we've seen, I don't want to make a definitive statement about this, but we have seen leaps in terms of social change happen at different times when a tipping point is reached. Mm-hmm. And where someone from, and I don't want to put too much emphasis on individual leaders now because I think it's less likely to happen that way in the future. But, you know, we did see the moment when Martin Luther King could speak, or Gandhi, or Jesus, or mm-hmm. Muhammad, mm-hmm. you know. So it's not like every single person has to be changed and then think. It's more mysterious than that, I think. As you ask, I realize I've been working more with the strategy of working with people who are already committed to change and helping them do it in a better way. Mm. So working with environmental leaders and working with, activists of different kinds, working with a friend of mine who'd be a great interview, George Mumford. He was the meditation teacher who taught the Lakers and the Bulls under Phil Jackson winning. And he taught meditation to those teams. And he and I worked with this group of ex-gang leaders, ex-con, ex-gang leaders who were working on the streets of Chicago to try to stop the violence. And there's a great documentary called The Interrupters made about them. Mm. And but they were amazing. They've all been in prison. They've all killed people. They've all been heads of gangs. They came out and decided that they wanted to do it. They wanted to stop the violence, that wasn't the way. And it was – that's part of a program that came out of a public health model once I think the CDC identified a street violence as an infectious disease. Mm. Anyhow, we went to Chicago and worked with these guys. They're almost all men, but a couple of women. And, you know, their job is to be on the street and they listen for when a murder happens because it's almost all gang related. Right. And so when one gang kills a person in another gang, there's always retaliation. And one of their main roles was to get in between and stop the retaliation. And right. they do it by talking to people and telling their stories. And they'd been very effective. But as I said, we're on the street listening all the time. Right. No one ever listens to us. I mean, and it's endless. I mean, there's so much violence going on. They're all burned out. And they respond. It was amazing to me. These are the toughest guys you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And they responded so beautifully to just being given a way to calm down and feel safe with each other and tell their stories and just breathe in and out. And then we did the listening practice.
Right, right.
And they loved it. And they really listened to each other. And at the end, they just fell into each other's arms. It was really beautiful. And then George continued to work with them. And they said that it really helped them do their work better. Yeah. And so That's one strategy of working with people who are already doing the good work.
Yeah.
And, you know, other people will come up with other strategies. I trust the power of these practices. I don't know about the timing, you know.
Right.
You know, the living through this winter, one wonders if how much time we've got left
right.
before climate change takes over. But, you know, I don't know, but I do know that it's one small part of helping us try to figure out how to live together.
Yeah. Is there anything else you'd want to say? Anything I haven't asked you? Anything you thought about and want to get out?
I'm starting to work on a book with my dear friend Ram Dass, who I've known since the days in India. And he is well known to many people because he wrote the great manual on this whole domain called Be Here Now.
Yeah.
And we've started writing a book on dying.
Mm.
So I'm thinking about that and how just being able to hold the reality of death as we do, as we live our lives fully, is an important part of practice.
Hmm.
Not to end on a down note, but it's a good thing to do.
Yeah. All right, Mirabai. Well, it's been delightful to be in your presence. Thank you so much. Thanks for driving all this way.
Thank you. I love talking to you, and I hope we have many more conversations.
Yeah, me too. All right. You take care and drive safely back.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.